Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's latest insult to allies, with the administration downgrading the diplomatic status of the EU without notifying the European Union, as heightened trade tensions between the EU and the US have European leaders trying to persuade Trump not to slap a 20% tariff on all cars imported from the EU. Charles Kupchan, who spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as special assistant to the President for National Security and was director for European affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, joins us to discuss the possibility that the EU and NATO could be the next deliberately created crisis after the border crisis Trump has manufactured has died down. Recently, Secretary of State Pompeo questioned the EU's role in a speech in Brussels, saying Brexit, if nothing else, was a political wake-up call. Is the EU ensuring that the interests of countries and their citizens are placed before those of the bureaucrats in Brussels? With that and Trump's remarks to the troops in Iraq, vowing the US was no longer going to be the sucker, we will assess what is behind Trump's penchant for trashing allies while gushing over enemies and the gratuitous childish insult to the European Union delegation in Washington. Then we'll assess whether the lies and distortions of data and statistics to generate a border crisis issuing forth from Trump, Pence, and the DHS Secretary Nielsen will catch up on the administration. May Nye, a professor of history at Columbia University who studies immigration, citizenship, and nationalism, joins us to discuss the racist underpinnings of focusing on a wall to keep brown people out, claiming the threat of terrorism, when of the 3,755 suspected terrorists who tried to enter the U.S. cited by the administration to Congress as their justification for a wall, only 6 were stopped on the Mexican border, while 41 tried to enter from Canada. Then finally, we will speak with Ryan Devereaux, a journalist who covers national security and criminal justice for The Intercept, where he has an article, How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis. He joins us to look into how much the far-right leaders of the Border Patrol Union are fueling Trump's hostility towards immigrants from Mexico and Central America, and the absurdity of staging a crisis to justify a military response when the solution being offered is to build a wall that will take years to complete and make it an open-ended crisis requiring the diversion of a large part of our military to a permanent deployment on the border. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And after spending the last 3 years of the Obama administration as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security, he's the author of Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Good to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Charles. And it was bad enough that back in July, President Trump, in a TV interview, when he was asked to name the biggest foes globally right now, President Trump started out by naming the European Union, calling it very difficult, before moving on to say, well, you know, there are also Russia and China. So what is happening now, though, because the German news service Deutsche Welle is now revealing that the Trump administration has downgraded the status of EU diplomats. That seems like a gratuitous and childish insult. So what are the actual real manifestations of a downgrade? Or what do we know about this? I mean, the administration is not being particularly forthcoming.
No, we don't really have a good set of facts to go on, but it appears that sometime in the last few months, the Trump administration made a decision to begin to treat the European Union as an international organization rather than as a country. And that means that its delegation in Washington, including its ambassador, take a back seat to representatives from individual countries. The upgrade occurred in the consequence, in the aftermath of the Lisbon Treaty in 2009, which gave the EU its own diplomatic corps. It now has its own foreign minister called a high representative. That is a woman from Italy named Federica Mogherini. And it was in the aftermath of those changes that I believe it was during the Obama administration a decision was made to upgrade the delegation to ambassadorial status. Trump has now downgraded it. It's a slap in the face. It's petty, and it's stupid, because Trump is really breaking with every post-World War II American president in seeing an integrated Europe as a threat to the United States rather than as a boon for the United States. After all, we went to war in World War I and in World War II to prevent the domination of Europe by a hostile power. We then deployed the Marshall Plan, and we deployed NATO to keep Europe whole and at peace. And then we at the end of the Cold War, tried to spread markets and democracy east. And it's been a remarkable success. And to have an American president who sees the EU as a foe, who treats Germany as in a backhanded way, it's really very short-sighted and very harmful for the United States. And as you mentioned, he's also welcomed Brexit. If Britain leaves the EU, which looks like it's about to happen, it's bad for Britain, it's bad for Europe, and it's bad for the United States.
So what is going on then in – I don't know what's going on in President Trump's mind, and I don't know how and who he's influenced. But having Stephen Bannon out there in Europe advising and strategizing with far-right political groups in Italy with Salvini, in Austria with Strache, with Le Pen in France, with Orban in Hungary – it's this. I mean, obviously, if you're promoting nationalism, and before the United Nations, Trump promoted nationalism, describing it as patriotism. Isn't that the inherent insanity of this? I mean, if you're the whole purpose of the European Union was to get rid of that kind of national insanity that created two world wars. By definition, it's a collective organization that's, you know, it literally opposed to nationalism. So if you're encouraging nationalism, you're trying to break up the EU, aren't you?
Well, I think there are three pieces to this. One is the one that you're talking about, which is, I think ideologically, Trump wants to take us back to a world of hard sovereign nation states, each looking out for itself. And he therefore opposes the EU on principled grounds, because he sees it as a multilateral organization, a post-sovereign entity that is, as you directly said, is trying to counter nationalism, not bring it to life. And then I think there are two other reasons that Trump has it out for Europe. One is that he sees Europe and Germany in particular as taking advantage of the United States. There are BMWs and Volkswagens and Porsches and Audis all over the place, and they pay very little duty, and the Europeans don't buy enough American cars. So he thinks they're fleecing us on the trade front. And then the other issue is they don't spend enough on defense. And the United States has all these troops in Europe, but a country like Germany is not meeting its pledge from the 2014 NATO summit to spend 2% on defense. Some of what Trump says is right. The Europeans should carry more of a burden on defense. But to launch this ideological jihad against our main ally in the world, our main partner when it comes to trying to defend democracy, republican values, multiculturalism, liberalism, constitutional rule, simply makes no sense whatsoever.
And the rule of law. And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service after having spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. And he's the author of Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. So while Trump is doing this, and again, it's pretty mystifying as to why, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. What possibly is so wrong about the fact that there's been peace in Europe and people the EU's become incredibly successful. And that Brexit is clearly a catastrophe for the British, and it's created political paralysis and economic, I don't know whether you could say ruin, but it's certainly, if it's a hard Brexit, then the City of London will tank. So there's no particular logic here, at least I'm sort of searching for one. But you have to contrast the fact that just the other day in this long, rambling 90-minute press conference, Trump was gushing over this beautiful letter. He called it a beautiful letter he got from Kim Jong-un, who's literally one of the world's worst, most murderous dictators. So if it doesn't bother you, which I imagine it does it puzzle you? Do you have any ideas, Charles Kupchan, of what how Trump has managed to turn the American foreign policy on its head?
Well, you know, part of it is I think he does have an affinity for strongmen, because it's not just Kim Jong-un. He also is drawn to Vladimir Putin. He's drawn to President Sisi in Egypt. He is defending Mohammed bin Salman, the heir apparent in Saudi Arabia, despite what appears to have been his order for the murder and dismemberment in Turkey of one of his opponents, Mr. Khashoggi. And at the same time, he turns his back on Merkel. He broke what was a decent relationship with Macron. The leader of Britain, Theresa May, is flailing in the wind trying to negotiate Brexit, and Trump undercuts her. So I really do think he is not at heart someone who understands or appreciates liberal democracy. And the other piece of this is that he has completely dismantled and broken the American foreign policy machine. We see it today, yesterday, the day before, with John Bolton, the national security advisor in Israel and then in Turkey, trying to tell everybody that, no, we're not actually withdrawing from Syria, even though the president said a few days ago that we are. And it's a complete mess. The system is broken. The system is not working. And that is, I think, another reason that we just see a scattershot foreign policy that to many people just doesn't make any sense.
So when you mentioned Trump's sudden pullout from Syria, which prompted the resignation of General Mattis, and his remarks over Christmas in Iraq, where he once went back to the theme that he's been beating up the NATO with, which is the idea that the U.S. is not going to be a sucker anymore, that somehow everybody else is a free rider and Uncle Sam is a sucker, which is certainly not the reality, particularly when you are the world's reserve currency. You could make the opposite argument. But is it possible? I mean, the only person who's really enjoying all this is Vladimir Putin. Could he do more damage, do you think, Trump? Could he? I mean, tonight in 45 minutes from now, he's, God knows what he's likely to say about a national emergency, but he can, under the rules laid out by the Congress, declare a national emergency. He has that power. So as commander-in-chief, I assume, he also has the power to suddenly pull the troops out of NATO. He also has threatened to pull the troops out of Afghanistan, which may not be such a bad idea, given that we're about to be in that losing war for 18 years. But do you have any concerns about, once this bogus crisis on the border is over, assuming it will be, he may turn to do something else, like pull out troops from NATO?
It's not outside the realm of possibility. There have been reports floating around that he has at times been tempted to talk about just kind of collapsing the alliance or taking forces out. He hasn't done that yet. He has been dismissive. he has been abrasive to NATO allies, but bottom line is that American troops are still where they've been over the last few years. And in fact, he has increased spending to fortify NATO's eastern frontier in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Crimea, the Donbass. And so at least on the ground, things are doing okay. But who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. And I do have a suspicion, a sinking feeling, that we have not seen the worst of it. And that now that we have a Congress, a House that's controlled by the Republicans, and we have investigations that are getting closer and closer to Trump and his family, it's impossible to know what he's going to do. So he's not done yet. There's a lot more damage that he can do while he is still president, and it's just impossible to say where it's going to come because his behavior is so unpredictable.
And with the Democrats in charge of the House, of course, the Senate appears to be AWOL. I mean, a terrible precedent is being set here by the president in basically making the American people pay for a wall that the majority of Americans don't want, that Mexico was supposed to pay for. He is basically holding the government hostage until he gets his wall, and once he gets his wall, he'll reopen the government. But I would think that most lawmakers, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, would have to see that as a terrible precedent to send, that from now on, do you think presidents, if they don't get their way, they'll just shut down the government?
Well, you know, the bottom line is that the Republican Party has essentially abandoned its responsibility to the nation since Trump has been president. You know, the Republicans know better. Is our immigration system broken? Yes. Does it need major overhaul? Yes. Is building a wall on the border with Mexico going to fix the problem? Absolutely not. I don't know anyone who knows a good bit about migration who thinks that that's what we should be doing. Right? We have 100 other things to spend money on to deal with the issue. We need legislation going through Congress, but Trump has a bee in his bonnet that if we just build a wall, a big, nice, beautiful wall, the problem is going to go away. Republicans know better than that. They need to speak up. Whether they're going to start doing so now that the House has flipped, I don't know. I do think that at some point, if Trump's poll numbers continue to go down, you will start seeing Republicans speak up. There have been a few defections in the last few days. A couple Republicans have challenged him on the wall. They're in swing states, Colorado and Maine, where there are tough re-elections. So there are signs that the Republican Party may come back to life. But at this point, they're still essentially going to go along because they know that the Republican base still stands solidly behind the president.
And why that's the case is a subject for another and long investigation and speculation. I wish I had the answers on that. But I thank you very much for joining us here today, Charles Kupchan.
Always a pleasure to join you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service after having spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration, a special assistant to President Obama for national security, and he's the author of Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is May Nye, who's Professor of History and the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens and the Making of Modern America, and her latest book is The Chinese Question. Welcome to Background Briefing, May Nye.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, May. And in the opening, which you missed, I said that we're going to be focusing on how there's a sort of racist underpinning to the wall to keep brown people out, claiming the threat of terrorism, when of the 3,755 suspected terrorists who tried to enter the U.S. cited by the Trump administration to Congress as their justification for a wall, only six were stopped on the Mexican border, while 41 tried to enter from Canada. So the question would be, May, don't you think we should put a wall on the Canadian border?
Well, you know, we are living in the land of the ridiculous right now. I mean, the fact that we have to even talk about these things shows how far we've descended down the rabbit hole. You know, I mean, none of the allegations the president makes about immigration from Mexico are based in fact. There is no empirical evidence for any of the things he's claiming, whether it's invasion, hordes of people, criminals, rapists, drug, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's all false. It's all fake news. So it's a political grandstanding. But you know what I want to say, Ian, what I was thinking about? It's obviously the dog whistle to his constituency. It's the it's a distraction from his own political troubles with the Mueller investigation. It's all those things. But what's really disturbing is that, and we'll see what he does at 9 o'clock, he's threatening to call a state of emergency. That is what I think your listeners have to look out for. Because what does it mean to call a state of emergency? Well, first of all, there is no national emergency. The evidence isn't there. And even if there were a national emergency, what does it mean? You can't build a wall overnight, right? So he's going to put troops there or whatever. But calling an emergency, a national emergency, means he's going to suspend all kinds of civil liberties. This is how fascism comes to power. Somebody's actually elected, you know, on a kind of scary, you know, fear-mongering platform, and they have a rabid, though minority, base. But what authoritarians do is that then they start chipping away at democratic procedures, constitutional norms. So if you call a state of emergency, that gives him even greater executive powers. And this is what I think we have to really be worried about.
Well, do you think then, given that it's a possibility that tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, Trump will call for a national emergency or declare a national emergency, or if not tonight, perhaps on Thursday when he goes down to the borders. I think it's a very, very real possibility. So what's going to save our democracy in the short term here? Do you think Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer following him are going to give a sufficient rebuttal? Do people care about facts anymore? I mean, for example, the illegal immigration, as it's called, to the southern border peaked at 1.6 million in 2000, and it's been on decline ever since then. And the Customs and Border Protection reported that 303,916, there were 303,916 apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border for fiscal year 2017, which is the lowest in more than 45 years. That's the objective reality. I don't know whether Pelosi and Schumer spouting statistics like I rambled through those, is going to be effective. What do you think will be effective?
Well, I think one has to make the empirical case that there is no emergency, there is no crisis. I mean, if there's any kind of crisis, it's a humanitarian crisis that this administration has created with regard to the asylum seekers from Central America. That is beyond shameful. And the administration is breaking domestic and international law by refusing to let asylum seekers into the country and making them wait, you know, excruciatingly long delays for a hearing before they even allowed to come to the portal, right, to the port of entry. So these are some things that are in the courts right now. But there's no crisis of hordes invading the country. It's completely ridiculous. So Pelosi and Schumer need to say that, but I think what needs to be done is the warning needs to be given about this authoritarian regime clawing its way into power. And if, you know, it's one thing what the Democrats will say. I mean, the question really is, as your former guest said, what are the Republicans going to do? What are the Republicans going to do? They can break this stalemate by voting for a budget and overriding a veto. But do they have the votes to override the veto? Do they have the guts to do that? You know, this is what needs to be done. You know, he can't just throw a temper tantrum because he didn't get the $5 billion he wanted. But I think that, you know, your question, what does it mean for our democracy in the short term? I'm very worried. Already we have seen assaults on the press. You know, the whole idea of fake news was his big campaign to smear the what he calls the MSM, right, the mainstream media, right, to discredit the Washington Post and the New York Times, right, let alone PBS, right, or MSNBC. You know, he smeared the entire media as being fake. You know, so these are the threats to our democracy that have already been unfolding, right? A journalist with the Washington Post is murdered in the most horrific way in the Middle East, and, you know, they wink at it. You know, this is the kind of thing. And then what's happening to immigrants is a violation of people's rights, especially, as I said, with regard to refugees and asylum seekers. The administration's breaking the law. So they're getting away with these things. And, you know, the thing we need to remember about authoritarian regimes is they start with the most vulnerable people, immigrants, refugees, asylum seekers. They start with the most vulnerable, and then it steamrolls, and then they come after everybody.
And again, I'm speaking with May Nye, who's a professor of history and the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens in the Making of Modern America, and her latest book is The Chinese Question. So could I paraphrase what you've said, May, and warned us about in terms of Trump declaring a national emergency? Would that be like handing matches to a pyromaniac?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, we could use any number of metaphors. You know, I mean, what we have to ask is, you know, is he going to curtail civil liberties? That's what executives typically do, or authoritarian executives typically do, when they have states of emergency. You know, it's I don't know if he'll go so far as to declare martial law. He probably won't go that far. But, you know, these are the things we have to be concerned about. I was going to say creeping authoritarianism, but I think it's actually galloping right now.
Well, the fact that the networks have given him this time is pretty alarming to begin with, because they, I think, understand, like, you know, the majority of Americans know that this is all about politics. This is a stunt to distract us, as you pointed out, from Mueller and other things that are closing in on Trump. So that's his MO. So it's hardly a national crisis, which he's trying to create. So he hardly deserves the platform of a national leader facing an emergency as opposed to a politician in trouble, trying to get out of trouble. So apparently there was some debate within the networks, but they've gone ahead and given him this opportunity to essentially try and, you know, con the American people into believing that there's a crisis down there in order to justify his wall, because he's, as he said in these meetings with Schumer and Pelosi, if I don't get the wall, I'll lose face with basically with Limbaugh and Coulter. So in effect, what we're dealing with here is the Limbaugh-Coulter shutdown. So that's the objective reality here. The networks didn't give Obama the opportunity to make a national address at one point. I can't remember when it was. I think it was in 2014. So it's not like it's unprecedented for the networks to turn down a president if they think he doesn't have a legitimate reason to address the nation as opposed to use the networks as a political platform.
Yeah, but in general, I do think it's hard for the networks to turn down the sitting president when he wants to address the nation. That's hard. That's a hard one.
Right.
But, you know, I think definitely there has to be a rebuttal. And hopefully there'll be enough rebuttal, not only from Schumer and Pelosi, but from everybody else to knock this down. I mean, look, Ian, he's got his 30%. Nothing's going to change those people's minds. Nothing.
But they're only 30%. It's only 30%. What's wrong with the 70%?
You know, I think the problem is, and if you look at Weimar Germany, if you look at other societies, you know, in the run-up to authoritarianism and fascism, the problem is that for a lot of people, their lives are not touched directly. They just go on living their lives. They're not bad people. They're not fascists themselves. You know, it doesn't touch them. They still go to work. They get paid, unless they work for the federal government, that is. You know, they can go out to nice restaurants. They can go on vacation. You know, they can, you know, most people aren't even that political. You and I are very different than the average person in this country. The average person isn't political.
Sure.
So, you know, there is like
a lot of good that does us, right?
Right. So, it's like an affliction. Part of that is because politics is a turnoff in this country. It's ugly. It costs so much money. You know, what have they done for me lately? I mean, it's, you know, at some level it's even understandable. But, you know, if you look at the response to Trump's first two executive orders, you know, the first two things he did when he came into office, he announced the Muslim ban and he announced the wall. And tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people demonstrated and said no. You know, they all showed up at JFK and LAX and everywhere in between. So I think that there are protests planned for this weekend. And, you know, hopefully the government can be opened and this thing can go away. You know, Nancy Pelosi said something very funny. I mean, I think she's even willing to do something that will let him save a little face, you know, by redefining what the wall is. Did you see that comment she made? She goes, well, I don't know. He's already backed down from concrete. I don't know what he wants. You know, maybe like a beaded curtain or something.
Right.
You know? So they can throw him a little bit of money for a beaded curtain, and then he can call it a victory, and we can go on, you know. But this whole thing, as I said in the beginning, we're in a land of reality TV, and it's beyond ridiculous. It's just beyond ridiculous. But unfortunately, people's lives are being damaged. Everybody from federal workers to migrants, you know, to refugees.
Well, we're also on the cusp of having all of our lives damaged, perhaps irreparably, if this declaration of emergency is used as a way to essentially as a step towards some kind of authoritarian rule, which has never happened in the United States. But the fact of the matter is the president can, under the existing statutes that the Congress have provided him with, he can declare a state of emergency. So just in the last couple of minutes, so let's assume he does that. What's going to stop him? Because he has the right to declare an emergency, but I'm not entirely sure that everybody's saying, well, there'll be a blizzard of legal challenges. You know, how long does that take? What happens to the Supreme Court? Do you have any sense of what is going to stop him if he really takes this very, very kind of, you know, strongman move?
Well, it's hard to say, but I think that there will be challenges, and I think he'll be stopped. And the challenges have to take place at two levels. They have to take place in the courts, and it have to take place in the streets.
So this should be, given that the day after he was inaugurated, there was a spontaneous manifestation of millions of women showing up across the streets in the United States and around the world. Would it take something on that level to get his attention?
I think it's not so much getting his attention. I think it's getting the attention of the judiciary.
And perhaps
to give the courts that backup.
Right.
So they can say this is bogus.
Right. Even Brett Kavanaugh, who has this peculiar idea of that Trump doesn't have enough executive authority.
Yeah, well, we'll see what he does.
Well,
but even Justice Roberts isn't looking quite so bad right now.
So right.
This is where we are.
Right. Well, that's what makes me wonder whether he sort of decided to stand up for the courts themselves, since Trump has trashed the judiciary and politicized it by accusing various judges of being Democrats, etc. You get the feeling that that's really got under Roberts' skin.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what he does.
Right. Well,
who knows?
I just in the last minute then, May, do you think that, as I mentioned in the opening, that we haven't touched on this, do you think that there's an underpinning of racism in all of what's going on here, given that the focus is on keeping brown people out, when I pointed out that the statistics for suspected terrorists being stopped that the Trump administration cited to the Congress as a justification for a wall, when you actually look into the statistics, you find that of the 3,755 suspected terrorists, only 6 were stopped on the Mexican border, while 41 tried to enter from Canada. So do you think that at the end of the day that there is a inescapable racism in the way that Trump and Miller and these characters operate?
It's manifestly and inescapably racist. Hmm. And what they don't want are brown people who eventually become voters. That's what they don't want.
Well, may not.
It's not just that they hate brown people, it's that they don't want to be voters.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Always a pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with May Nair, who's a professor of history and the Long Family Professor of Asian American Studies at Columbia University, a legal and political historian interested in questions of immigration, citizenship, and nationalism. She's the author of Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens, and the Making of Modern America. And her latest book is The Chinese Question. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ryan Devereaux, who's a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept, where his latest article is How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Devereaux.
Thanks for having me.
And you wrote about the Trump administration trying to gin up a new border crisis back in October. And it seems so clear to me, and I'm astounded why it's not clear to most Americans, maybe it is, that this whole thing is yet another reality TV stunt on the part of Donald Trump to distract us from the fact that he doesn't know how to govern. He just pulls off these constant stunts. So how far do you think he's prepared to take this, since he sort of trapped himself by saying that he would own, we'd be proud to own the mantle of being responsible for a government shutdown? Do you think, since he's trapped himself in that regard, that he's going to go all the way and in about half an hour from now, I guess, declare a national emergency?
Well, I think if we've learned anything in the last couple of years as the Trump administration has taken office, it's that we probably shouldn't overextend ourselves in making predictions. The latest reporting that I've seen from the Wall Street Journal is that it seems that President Trump won't declare a national emergency tonight. But who knows? The president is who he is, and we are all subject seemingly to his whims. What it seems that the president is going to talk about, however, is what he's been talking about since 2015, since he came in, which is his version of a nightmarish crisis on the border in which hordes of brown people are pouring into the United States and extraordinary measures are needed to combat that flow. There is a humanitarian crisis on the border. There is a real crisis along the border, but it's not the one that the president describes to his base over and over again that he's been talking about for going on 4 years now.
Is it the crisis that the president has created, or at least in part, a crisis that the president himself and his administration have created?
Yes, absolutely. The administration, the Trump administration, has contributed directly to the crisis that we're seeing on the border right now by essentially locking down lawful ports of entry across the border to asylum seekers. What folks should know is that over the last several decades, immigration levels have dropped to numbers that we haven't seen since the 1970s. Overall, illegal crossings are down. What's up, however, is the crossings of families coming to the United States to seek asylum. The Trump administration describes the asylum process as one of what they describe as catch and release. Basically, what they are attempting to do and what they've done is shut down ports so that asylum seekers can't come into the United States, basically creating a bottleneck at all of these ports, which causes people to seek other means to get into the United States to apply for asylum, which is legal under domestic and international law. So we do have a crisis of asylum seekers building up on the border. What we don't have is a national security crisis of criminals and terrorists flooding into the country, which is what the administration would lead you to believe.
So, as you just mentioned, Ryan Devereaux, border crossings are a very low level. I think you have to go back to the 70s. And while the number of asylum seekers are going up, it's still not in any way a crisis. And furthermore, how do you build a wall to face and solve a crisis? A wall that's going to cost, aside from where you get the money from, and it's obviously not coming from Mexico, no matter if you do get the money somehow or other, it's going to take you at least a year or maybe two to build a damn thing. So you can't say you have a crisis that somehow 2 years later we can forestall before we have the magical wall to save us from this crisis. I mean, it's just there's no logic to that. If we have a real crisis, then you need to put a wall up immediately. So is this crisis somehow going to be postponed for 2 years while Trump gets his wall?
Well, I think you've put your finger right on it. A multi-year infrastructure project is not the solution to a crisis of the moment, obviously. A border wall is not going to stop drugs coming in, because the vast majority of the expensive drugs that Mexican organized crime smuggles into the United States comes through the ports. And most of the undocumented immigrants in the United States are undocumented immigrants because they've overstayed visas, not because they're crossing the border. The wall is an idea, a symbol that Trump uses to rally his base. It's about so much more than the things that he purports it to be about. You need to read between the lines when Trump is talking about the wall. It's nationalist messaging to his base. It's him saying, I'm still here, I'm still with you. It's him whipping up anxieties about changing demographics in the United States. I mean, it's very clear what the president is doing here. I think most reasonable people can see what's happening. It's not about the wall and what the wall would actually do or whether it would even exist.
And again, I'm speaking with Ryan Devereaux, a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept, where he has an article, How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis. Well, Trump, of course, is likely to say anything because he's in a fact-free zone, and his vice president has been trying to do some cleanup on the idea that Trump recently said that all former presidents who he's consulted with agree with him that we need a wall. Well, that was just a blatant, bald-faced lie, and even Pence couldn't wiggle his way around that one. Given the president's loose association with the truth, what do you think the responsibility of the broadcasters are in letting him go on prime time and pitch his pseudo-crisis or try to gin up this crisis in a national address? Because it wouldn't be the first time, had it happened, that the major networks had denied a president prime time. They did it with Obama. So why are they caving to Trump when it's so obvious that this is a manufactured crisis by Trump, and Trump is going to use the rubric of a national emergency to make a national address, and who knows what he's going to say?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I think that it's one that newsrooms and producers need to consider and answer, because as you mentioned, it's pretty clear what's happening here, what this address is all about. And, you know, regardless of whether we have Democrats coming on TV afterwards to offer a rebuttal, the damage is done once this address is it's finished, once a president gets his message across. And so I think that we need to take really seriously the question of whether or not an address that seems so clearly designed to stir up nationalist fervor is the kind of thing that should be broadcast into hundreds of millions of Americans' homes.
So, Ryan, when you wrote your article, How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis, you looked into what's going on the border, particularly in the Sonoran Desert. And we know that Donald Trump is getting his advice from these heads of the Border Patrol Union. They've been featured recently in a photo op where he walked into the press room, surprised everybody, and gave a big shout out to these big burly guys with skinheads who apparently have been in and out of the White House a lot, presumably at the invitation of Stephen Miller, and have been the main source of information that Trump's getting about this so-called crisis. But isn't there a lot of going on down on the border, behind the scenes, if you will, where humanitarian groups are trying to help these people who get stranded and die in the deserts by, for example, leaving caches of water, and that the Border Patrol in turn goes and destroys these caches? I'm just trying to get a handle on what's going on with the Border Patrol in terms of their rank and file, whether they are becoming a bunch of Trumpsters.
It's a really important subject, and one I've spent the last year devoting a majority of my time to, traveling back and forth to the Sonoran Desert in Arizona, where humanitarian groups who have worked for years putting water out in the desert for migrants have found themselves under attack by the Trump administration, with multiple volunteers over the last year charged with federal crimes, including one volunteer who's facing 20 years in prison for having provided food, water, and shelter to two undocumented men over the course of 3 days. This is all part of a broader crackdown orchestrated by the administration along the border that features the work of, as you mentioned, Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and the Border Patrol Union, which is one of the most aggressive and far-right law enforcement unions in the country and has the ear of the president directly. And in the last couple months, we've seen reports of heads of the Border Patrol in the White House advocating successfully on their positions in terms of authorizing the military to use lethal force in support of border security operations. The Border Patrol Union has become, over the last several years, as Trump rose to and came to power, an extremely effective force in getting their agenda across, and their agenda aligned almost directly with Stephen Miller's and Stephen Bannon's, who in turn draw their sort of thinking about the world from a sort of long lineage of white nationalist literature and sort of anti-immigrant posturing. It goes back generations.
But has there been any polling on the rank and file in the Border Patrol to see what percentage are Trumpsters? Because there's some diversity in the ranks of the Border Patrol. They're not all white skinheads.
That's absolutely true, and a really important point. So I've spent a good amount of time over the last year talking to Border Patrol agents about the union and whether the union represents them. And you know, to a person, I hear the same thing. And it's like, you know, we just, you know, we clock in and clock out. We do our jobs, and, you know, we try to, you know, just sort of go home at night. And what the union is doing, going on Fox News every day and sort of parodying the Trump talking points, is it's not clear to me that they are speaking to the will of every single agent in the rank and file. That's not to say that there aren't plenty of agents who do agree with that sort of political line of thinking. But it seems that the union has really staked out a space as a sort of far-right entity that might not quite represent every sort of Border Patrol agent out there doing the job.
So it's a bit like the NRA doesn't necessarily represent everybody in the United States who has a firearm.
Of course. I mean, we're talking about an agency with thousands and thousands of employees who all hold their own sort of political opinions. And oftentimes when you get down to the border and you actually talk to people who are there, the view from the ground is much more nuanced than what you hear in D.C. and what you hear, you know, on cable news.
So what's going to happen then to the rank and file when they start not getting a paycheck, which I think is today or tomorrow, they're not going to get paid? And these are the people, we already know that the Coast Guard are not getting paid, and they have an important role protecting the borders. So if the front line on border protection, the Border Patrol, aren't getting paid, two questions. How is it going to affect the rank and file? Because Trump keeps claiming that everybody in the government is not getting a paycheck loves what he's doing, which, you know, obviously is extremely suspect. And the second question would be, what are these heads of this Border Patrol union, these far-right guys, how are they going to tell their rank and file what a great job they're doing getting their paychecks?
Well, the answer to the first question, I think, is pretty clear. People are going to be mad. They're going to be upset that they're not getting paid. And I think the answer to the second question, you know, we can sort of look to what the union has been doing from the very beginning, which is falling directly in line with the president's talking points. They'll probably blame the Democrats and they'll blame Congress, and they'll say that this is a sign of a broken government that doesn't want to fix the problems. And, you know, the president has his hands tied by, you know, a bunch of limp-wristed politicians in D.C. So what they've basically been saying from the beginning. So I think that we can kind of, I think that it is fairly easy to predict the way this is all going to be spun by the union.
Well, then just in the last couple of minutes, Ryan Devereaux, assuming that Trump declares a national emergency and he's going down the border on Thursday, so I don't know what he's going to announce then, but I believe the following day, Friday, is the day that this government shutdown that he's using to blackmail the Congress to get his way will be the longest. So that's a sort of yardstick that he may not want to cross. But let's assume that he tries to go around Congress with this idea of a national emergency and and taps into the DOD's vast slush fund and sends a whole lot more troops down on the border, perhaps even making them build this damn wall, whatever it is, or fence or whatever he calls it, today or tomorrow. So do you expect that to go smoothly? Because I have a feeling that just as we were talking about how the rank and file in the Border Patrol don't necessarily agree with the far-right views of their own union leaders, maybe the rank and file in the military don't agree with the idea that they should be down there building Trump's wall.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to assume that some number of rank and file troops would have serious problems with that mission. But we should also keep in mind that it wasn't too long ago, just a few months back, when I wrote the article you were discussing earlier, that you know we saw Operation Faithful Patriot, which was the most sort of naked example of the military being used to further a political agenda. You know, this administration's basically hardline and anti-immigrant political agenda, and they went through with it. You know, they didn't dissent, they didn't stop it from happening, and there are still troops down there on the border. So I don't know if I have a whole lot of faith in, you know, the military pumping the brakes on this.
Well, what then can stop it? I mean, if he goes ahead and declares a national emergency, he has the right to do that. Whether it's an emergency or not, it would be the real question. How do you think that's going to work out? Do you think there's enough sensible people in this country to realize that they're being conned by the con man in chief?
Well, I mean, I think plenty of people in this country realize that already. You know, again, predicting things is dangerous in this time period. But if I have to, and the question is, how will this all go down? I would predict that it'll be a total mess, which is essentially, you know, has been par for the course with this administration on matters of immigration from day one. It'll be a disaster, but that has been what we've seen, you know, from the get-go.
Well, Ryan Devereaux, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ryan Devereaux, who's a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept, where he has an article, How the Trump Administration is Manufacturing a New Border Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, the headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. One more light goes out in America.